We usually start interviews with some biographical material. Now, you received your bachelor's at Princeton in 65, but what about your earlier life and your family?
Okay, I was born and brought up in Hanover, New Hampshire. My parents both were employed at Dartmouth College. My father was a professor of civil engineering, now retired. My mother was a librarian at the college, now retired also. I went to the Hanover Public Schools and graduated from Hanover High School before going on to Princeton for my undergraduate education. I have one sister, 4 years older than me.
Let's see, what level of education did your parents have?
My father has a master's in engineering, and my mother has a master of library science.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your early home life prepared you for a scientific career?
Yes. Very much so. Both of my parents are incisive, objective thinkers, and I was very much brought up in a family life that valued education, valued reading, and my father's training in engineering definitely gave me a sense of how scientific training has practical application in one's immediate life. So I think that both my level of educational accomplishment and my particular orientation towards science both have their origins in my early home life. My mother's father was a professor of mathematics at Dartmouth College, in fact the chairman of the department for a period. So was a strong background in scientific and academic work.
Mm-hmm. Were there any grade school or secondary school teachers who had a particular impact on you that you recall particularly well?
In science, only negatively so. I had teachers at Hanover High School that I thought were, they were small. The one in particular who taught me physics, I remember, was really quite a small-minded person, and I had a sense that I was thinking circles around him, and that irritated the hell out of him, so that we had there was more tension than learning. On the other hand, in mathematics, I do remember having some teachers who I thought were good, but my general recollection of both math and science in junior high school and in high school was that it was something that I did easily and well, and it gave me a feeling of orientation toward further education in the sense that it was something that I could do and do reasonably well, so that I remember it being pretty easy on the whole. Mm-hmm. But I think it was definitely good preparation, but not particularly challenging. There was one summer while I was in high school that I went to an advanced study program given at the St. Paul's School in Concord, Massachusetts, in Concord, New Hampshire, a summer program for advanced studies to supplement high school curricula for gifted students. And that was particularly interesting. I took an advanced mathematical course that summer in higher algebra, and that was I remember that as being an outstanding point in my high school education.
it was more challenging than, than what you were used to in the course of the year. So college, pretty much a foregone conclusion.
Going to college was a an absolutely foregone conclusion.
What about the deciding on Princeton?
Well, the I guess I only applied two places. One was Princeton and one was Dartmouth. Getting into Dartmouth was a foregone conclusion, I guess. My father was a Dartmouth alumnus. I think he would have enjoyed having me stay around. I mean, not enjoyed, I said that wrong, wouldn't have enjoyed me particularly staying around, but would have enjoyed me going to his alma mater. I would have gone to Dartmouth if I hadn't gotten into Princeton. I think I would have gotten a good education in both places. The advantage in going to Princeton was that it got me away from my roots and showed me, you know, the outside world beyond the back country of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a particular field in mind? Any notions as to a major?
I had two thoughts in mind when I went to Princeton. It was that I had a very clear choice in front of me, either to major in mathematics or one of the physical sciences, and I, in the the way I thought of it then was that that would have been kind of, that would have been in some sense a cop out or something that I would just do because I could do it and it would be easy. The alternate was to major in philosophy or in something or in possibly in literature or one of the creative arts. And I, at that time, I posed that possibility to myself as this is the more essential way to engage life. Try to cut out a hard profession, one that isn't just objective but engages the whole person and asks more fundamental questions about life. I guess I thought if I failed as a philosopher, then I could go on and be a mathematician or a physicist. When I got to Princeton, though, and actually dug into both kinds of challenges, it emerged to me that, in fact, the physical sciences and mathematics were a very high art form and challenging creatively in their own way. What the bug that bit me at Princeton was German language. I picked up, I studied German starting as a freshman and became very interested in it, and in particular became interested in how that there were certain thoughts expressed through that language, and in particular by the great poets and philosophers who have written in German that I thought were new dimensions on living, new ways to approach life. It was as if each language, it appeared to me, presented a new way to view life's essentials. And so I was very much captivated by German. I studied it all the way through Princeton, nearly majored in it. In fact, the ultimate choice when I became a junior was to whether I was going to go on in German or go on in physics. So I chose physics. I continued to pursue the German. I studied all the way through middle high German, and as a matter of fact, was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to go to the University of Munich following my Princeton career, but I did not do that. I actually turned down that scholarship and went to Harvard, starting out graduate school immediately rather than delaying it for the year in Europe.
So your that's right, your degree from Princeton was an AB.
That's right.
I wasn't sure whether that was a misprint.
That was my undergraduate degree.
Yeah. How did you choose Harvard?
Well, because they had a first-class physics department, and I thought I could perhaps delay a little bit longer choices of exactly what specialty in physics I would go into. I didn't figure I could go far wrong, and as it turned out, I'm very pleased with the way the choice turned out.
Had you developed any interest in astronomy by this time,
particularly? Not a serious one. In fact, the only astronomy course that I took in my life, I took at Princeton. And that was a course in stellar atmospheres taught by Professor Rogerson. The reason I took it, I remember very clearly, was that you had to take an astronomy course to get a key to get into the telescope building. And I wanted to use the refracting telescope that at that time was at the corner of Prospect Street before they tore it down. They tore down the building while I was a senior, I guess. And I wanted to be able to go into that nice old building and open the shutters and move the telescope around and just look. And so I enrolled in the physics course, and I don't remember a great deal about it. It had to do with stellar atmospheres and the Saha equation.
Yes.
And that's pretty much all I remember about it. So the only time I ever addressed astronomy as a separate academic undertaking was in that single course.
Had you done any amateur astronomy or telescope building or anything like that?
No, I hadn't. I had looked through telescopes at Dartmouth, but I didn't have any, except for the fascination anybody who spends a lot of time in the outdoors naturally has by looking up at the stars. I didn't have any direct fascination for astronomy.
So you get to Harvard, and you're in a physics.
I was in a pure physics program.
Pure physics program.
And my Harvard student career was working with a single physics professor throughout. His name is Pipkin, Frank Pipkin, who was a superb scientist at that time. He had probably more than 10, maybe less than 15 graduate students spread over three completely orthogonal or independent areas of experimental physics investigation. That included a high energy physics group, a group doing nuclear orientation experiments, and a group that I was on the first wave of that has continued to this day, and that was a group studying, I shouldn't say I was on the first wave of it because it was in fact there for several years before I came, and that was a group studying atomic physics, the measuring the internal structure of atoms through radio frequency spectroscopy. And when I got admitted to Harvard, I wrote to the department asking if there wasn't a summer job I could come and work on before the fall semester began, and got a letter back from Frank Pipkin saying, I've got a job for you if you want to come, and I did, and went and worked that summer and stayed and worked right through a thesis topic with him.
Mm-hmm. And still this is... well, there are astronomical applications, but you're still in pure physics for the most part.
It's pure physics. My formal training is in pure physics and mathematics. And what I'll get straight to the bottom line, I've found that superb, not only as a discipline, understanding atomic physics intimately, not only understanding that as a discipline has been enormous help to me in astronomy, but also the experimental techniques, the series, the habits, the mental checks, the almost reluctant drawing to a conclusion out of experimental studies that I picked up working with a skeptical experimentalist in the laboratory was superb training for then going on and doing observational astronomy. In other words, it's true that that whole training was in one area that is embedded in astronomy, but the formal training has served me very well in giving me habits and detailed understanding of the particulars.
Mm-hmm. Somebody was telling me that they were told by a professor when they were considering a choice between astronomy and physics, go into physics because you can always pick up any astronomy you'll need along the way.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily true the other way around, even if you go into a strong astrophysics program.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. In fact, I could take a more radical point of view, and that is that you can tell a good solid training in any experimental science by testing it, by applying it to some other orthogonal field. If you've got the right habits for one field, they are transferable to another field. You know how to ask the right questions. You know how to recognize good data practices from bad data practices. So it's also true, Stephen Gould, in a recent column in Natural History, I guess is where he writes, isn't
yeah.
it? Made a point in his, I guess it was his 100th column, and he said, I'm going to take the luxury of talking a little bit about my own background. And in that column, he made a particular point, which was that his specialty, which was studying the snails at one end of an island in the Caribbean or some funny, very minute field, gave him, by knowing one small area in great vertical extent, gave him the power to understand and converse over the wide range of science. And he pointed out, in that same column, he pointed out what the specialties were of some of the men that we would recognize their names as being the great men of science. And in each case, in his examples, the particular field of their specialization was something microscopic or abstruse or something that you didn't identify the person with at all. But the point was that here were great scientists who went abroad on the and wide were wide-ranging great statesmen in science, but they had their training by very high specialization in one particular field, and that provided them the right habits and the right orientation to be able to work from there.
Darwin's barnacles.
That's right, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So this takes you to 68 with a master's in physics, and had you had any awareness of what was going on at Harvard in astronomy, or know anybody from the astronomy department?
Not really. I did go up there occasionally. The Harvard Astronomy Department is remote from the main campus, so that you have to go out of your way to go up to the observatory. I did go up there occasionally. They had a good library, but I really did not interact strongly with the astronomers up there until after my degree.
After your master's?
No, the master's. Picking up the master's was just a paper exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I just filled out a form to get the master's. It wasn't involved in.
So then you followed that with a research fellowship at the Center for Earth and Planetary Physics.
That was after my degree.
That was after your degree.
So that was my first employment was in, as you can see, in the Center for Earth and Planetary Physics. Now, I have to explain what was going on there. The particular person with whom I got that job, his name is Richard Goody, former chairman of the Space Science Board, the National Academy, one of the statesmen in planetary science in this country. He was wanting to start up an experimental program to complement his work in preparing the Pioneer Venus mission. He was, as much as anyone, the intellectual father of the Pioneer Venus mission, and he wanted to set up an experiment to image Venus at 10 microns wavelength in the thermal infrared. And what he wanted was someone with, you know, who is there around who knows how to set up an experiment and do it. And my name was suggested to him, I think, by Nathaniel Carleton, who was in the physics, who had close connections with the Harvard Physics Department. In fact, that's where he got his PhD from also. Nat was in the Center for Earth and Planetary Physics, and Nat was also, at that point, building for the Smithsonian the 60-inch telescope on Mount Hopkins in Tucson, Arizona.
The Center for Earth and Planetary Physics? Center for Astrophysics.
No. Wait a minute. I think I said it right the first time. Nat was also a member of the Center for Earth and Planetary Physics, which is where Goody was.
Right.
Okay, but he had a foot in the physics department and knew what was going on there.
Okay.
And these two places are next door to one another, so that there's close proximity, and Nat was the pollinating influence in this situation. And so I came around and had an interview with Goody and with Nat, and their objective was, Goody's objective was to have this imaging experiment. Nat was building the telescope, and Richard Goody had a NASA grant from Bill Brunk. No, it wasn't actually in Bill Brunk's office at that time. This was in the Atmospheres program, if I'm not mistaken.
It
would have been Brinton's predecessor. But it wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't remember who it was. He retired at the time.
Begins with an F, and I can't think of his name. He's now on a farm in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I tracked him down, but I haven't
right.
been in touch with
okay.
him.
Okay. Well,
yet.
It was in his office, and the money was there for the equipment and for my salary and traveling back and forth, and nobody had done any work on it, and so it was up to me to sit down and invent a system that took light from Venus and imaged it in a detector. And that sounded to me like the juiciest challenge ever. I mean, here was the money to do it, and no implementation was planned out. So what I did was sat down and just designed from ground up. I was suddenly learning all about infrared detectors and black bodies and computers, and I basically built completely from scratch and completely by my own design, I did all the electronic interfacing myself with my own soldering gun, and built a complete computer-controlled experiment that maintained real-time image stabilization. I built all the whole bloody thing, data transfers and then data analysis back at Harvard. So that, and the time frame was, that job began, I guess, in 71, and the experiment was working by 74 or 5. At that point, another person came on the project, Jay Apt, and
son of
no, not Helmut Apt.
Not any relation. To,
not any relation to Helmut. Okay. No, this is APT, Jerome APT.
Ah, okay.
And Jay kind of took over that project and actually was by the time Pioneer Venus actually came by, he was the one operating it.
Now, is this flight hardware?
No. This is
a brand.
This operated at the in my round of it. It was operating at the coup de focus of the 60-inch telescope on Mount Hopkins, built by the Smithsonian.
Okay.
And there are references in here to the images that to the science that was done on that. Let's see. Brown and Goody, 78, The Persistence and Size of Thermal Anomalies on Venus, published in Icarus. With some, it's most of the way down the A3.
This has a description of the instrumentation?
Yep.
In it?
Yep.
Okay.
And, let's see. But at the same time I was doing that, I thought I ought to go off and learn about a telescope, since I'd never used a telescope before. So thing number one was to try to think of an experiment that would take me, that would get me acquainted with a telescope. So I began to potter about and see who had what equipment. There is a Harvard telescope at Harvard, Massachusetts, actually, which is 30 or so miles outside Cambridge. And it's confusing. There's a town called Harvard. And it is a 61-inch telescope, doesn't get a lot of use, or didn't at that time, because it's pretty cloudy. On the other hand, it's a very convenient site. Richard Goody suggested that I might want to do something with the Galilean satellites, since not a lot of modern work had been done on them for a while. So with that in mind, I looked around and found a very smart guy who was one of the fathers of stellar or astronomical interferometry that time. His name is Mertz, Larry Mertz. He was at the Smithsonian at that time. He had a little interferometer that he just built up himself. It wasn't any bigger than a 6 by 6 inches, and plugged into the back of the 61-inch telescope, and dumped its data to an audio recorder, which then he could play back to a mini computer, and it would digitize and then do the Fourier transform and get the spectrum back. It provided low-resolution images, low-resolution spectra, something like 6 or 10 angstroms in the visible.
This is what year?
This is 1971.
71. Got a Fourier transform.
It was a birefringent spectrometer, no bigger than this.
Incredible.
It was the cutest little thing you could imagine.
Because the possibility of seriously doing Fourier transform work didn't really arise until the early 60s, and you're only talking 8 or 9 years
after. Right. Well, Mertz is generally credited as being one of the pioneers in that field. And so I thought, well, here's a piece of equipment. Now, what can I do with it? And I thought, well, let's compare the visible spectra of the Galilean satellites. So I designed an experimental program, which was to go out to the telescope and just spend 5 or 10 minutes on each of the 4 satellites, one after the other, and obtain the data, then co-add it later on in the computer. But the idea was to mesh all the observations so that anything like drifts in transparency or drifts in color by looking through the atmosphere at different angles, they'd all be nulled out, and you could go back and make it so that it was as if you had obtained 4 simultaneous spectra of the satellites, so you could compare them. So I took the data, this is all interleaved with this building up this infrared imaging experiment. This was all, yeah. I was just bootlegging this time, basically.
And the, how did you pick up the awareness and the knowledge of the kinds of systematic instrumental potentials for error and all the other kind of bread and butter issues that one usually gets while being trained in graduate school somehow or another in doing observational astronomy?
That's where I have to return to the point I made before, which is that it was my training in sound experimental techniques, I think, that made me want to do something the results of which were everything, so that everything was under control and I was able to focus on one particular thing. I wanted to, in this case, to get a signal from the four satellites, have it so that they could be compared without any judgment about something else that could happen. So I wanted it to be a highly controlled experiment. So I came to the telescope wanting to do something that was highly controlled in the sense that I would do it back in the laboratory.
Right.
And it was just my good sense that made me do that. And it turned out that a significant discovery came out of this. Namely, that when I ratioed the four spectra together, the result was that there was an anomaly in the case of Io. And around the sodium D lines, there was extra light. Mm-hmm. And that was the discovery of the sodium cloud around Io. So that my very first experimental work turned into a significant discovery, which has led now to the realization that there are heavy ions and atoms in the Jovian magnetosphere, and which are now a key to understanding both the nature and the governing physics of that magnetosphere, and they're also diagnostic tracers of the geophysical phenomena that go on there. Okay. So that turned out to be a really hot item, and yeah. My vita shows that through the next years, in fact, to the present, studying the properties of the Jupiter magnetosphere through the diagnostic emissions of those heavy atoms and ions around Jupiter has been a mainline activity, and it's probably the thing for which I'm best known at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Now the other planetary research that I was doing during the same period was remeasuring the rotation rate of Uranus. It turns out that's a really fascinating problem. If you look in any book before 1976, look up the rotation rate of Uranus, you'll see something quoted right down to the seconds, 10 hours and some number of seconds, that came out of a measurement in 1930. And a very small amount of thought about how that spectrum was taken in the presence of poor guiding and poor seeing, or the best that could be done at that time. There were definite systematic effects associated with that.
This would have been a Slipher spectrum.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And Moore and Menzel actually worked on it later. And their answer stuck around for most of 40 years until it became re-examined in the mid-1970s, and we were, Goody and I were one of the first people to go back and remeasure that number. We found, we published two papers on our results. We used the Cassegrain-Eschelle spectrograph at the 4-meter telescope at Kitt Peak. We did what we think is a very careful data analysis. And we come up with a number of 16 hours. And if you look in the ephemeris, the American Ephemeris Nautical Almanac, you'll see our number in there.
Yeah.
But that isn't the end of the story, though. Unfortunately, a whole bunch of other people went back and remeasured the same number, and now there's a difference of a factor of 2 on the books in published rotation rates for Uranus, so that Until Voyager goes by and settles the question, it'll have to be considered an open issue. But there are many reasons. There are several independent lines of reasoning that at this point somewhat favor the 16-hour measurement that we have, but it is a highly controversial issue at the moment. Mm-hmm. So then in the late 1970s, early 80s, I did some radio measurements of thermal emission from the Galilean satellites with Imke de Peter. That's interesting stuff, because you have to figure out what you have to interpret it. You need to really have some idea of how rough the surface is and how deep inside the boundary layer of the surface the radio emission is actually being formed. So, and there are some very peculiar properties of the satellites when you compare one to another in terms of both their radio reflectance, their radio emission, and also their radar reflection. So that's a fascinating topic.
Yeah. So you just, as far as astronomy goes, you just started doing planetary astronomy from the start. And there was never any...
No, as a matter of fact, I've never taken any formal courses in planetary science either. So I'm basically coming at these applied disciplines of planetary science or astronomy from the point of view that I understand how to do experiments, make measurements, interpret them for their information content, and make definite statements about the astronomical locations that the light is created in. In other words, I'm a strict disciplinarian, if something you want to say. I take what I know and try to see what it says in simple senses about the remote locations.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider getting more deeply involved in the planetary flight program?
That's another interesting thing. All of my projects, to the time I came to the Space Telescope, were all of those projects were one-man projects. The infrared imaging experiment I built at the University of Arizona wasn't the only piece of instrumentation I built by myself. While I was at the University of Arizona, I designed and built with NSF funding a Cassegrain shell spectrograph that was a very innovative and challenging project. So I like to get my hands on to equipment. I know how to make it perform well. I know how it has to behave to adequately address a scientific question, and I'd like to basically understand all the aspects of a problem and work them through. I'm able to manage in my mind large extended projects that involve multiple types of activity, people activities and data analysis activities and hardware activities. I know how to use a lathe and a drill press and a milling machine and actually get things to work. And if at the telescope some piece of equipment fails, I know how to tear it apart and debug it. Uh-huh. And frankly, jumping way ahead, those same instincts are serving me very well working on the Space Telescope, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum by about four or five orders of magnitude.
Yes, I'm going to have a lot of questions about your switch to a new environment and what carries over and what doesn't.
Right. So it's very much true that my background is in small scientific projects. I like to take immediate charge of what's going on. I know how to delegate responsibility for pieces, but I also know how to track very well how the progress is going on them. Now, I'm speaking about my small scale operations, and I have avoided large collaborations.
Where there's not quite so much control possible on
yeah. Well, the other thing, the other thing that has always kind of turned me off about, obviously, as soon as I got into planetary science after my degree at Harvard, I was suddenly going to meetings and had as my colleagues people that were at JPL and were in the big planetary programs, and I'll have to say that they. That I felt somewhat turned off both by I felt somewhat turned off by those projects, and I think for two reasons. One is that they seem to have a very high component of self-serving politics in them. It seemed that a lot of things got justified just for the sake of keeping things going or keeping momentum and funding with the scientific points or motivations being often less visible, at least to people that were on the outside. Now, I have more sympathy for that now. I realize that in order to get the funding and keep the momentum going on such a large space projects, you need a certain amount of lubricant in the system. The second was that I found that the scientists who got involved in those projects tended not to have as sharp a critical edge on their research as people that were in pure academic environments. Just the achievement of the data, the success of the mission, the pretty pictures, seemed to be a sort of a seductive and superficially satisfying exercise in itself. And the hard work of determining what exactly was the information content, or how accurately did one know this, or how accurately did one need to measure something in order to get a certain uncertainty in the to achieve a certain level of accuracy in the actual scientific quantity that one was after and was justifying this, that I found to be the weaker part, at least as it came across in the sort of love-ins that would follow the encounters and the planning. So the selling of these programs, the spirit in which they went on, the backslapping between the contractors, the whole big money scene, just seemed to me to be, if not at cross purposes with science, certainly seemed to degrade it in some sense.
Mm-hmm. Let me flip the tape. Yep. Getting an end of tape signal.